Well, perhaps we should make a start. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor George Patterson to our series on comparative mysticism. George is Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at Christ Church, and he's well known to most of you, I imagine. He's written books on existentialism and theology. His latest one is God and Being, I think, which is yet to come out.
In October.
And he recently launched, which I was unable to attend, a book on art and religion, and he's had interest in contemporary art. Bill Verola, he's interviewed in various other things, Russian philosophy, Kierkegaard, and so on. I first came upon George's work in a wonderful book called Anxious Angels, which I found in a bookshop one day, and before I met him, before I knew about him. And
it's got a good cover, hasn't it?
It's got a great cover, yes. So he covers a wide range of Christian existentialism and has a deep interest in Christian mysticism. And today he's going to talk to us about understanding apophaticism. Now, enough of you must have known what apophaticism is to come here today, so I have heard of the word. Some people don't know it. Anyway, so George, over to you.
Okay. So actually one of my professorial colleagues, whom I won't name, admitted today that the word apophaticism is off their radar. had to be explained. I shall be discussing apophaticism, but as Gavin has just said, one of my long-standing interests really is in existentialism, and especially Christian existentialism, though not exclusively Christian existentialism. And one of the things which I will be looking at in this paper is links between Christian mysticism and Christian existentialism, with specific regard to this issue of apophaticism. So it's not really a general paper about apophaticism in the Christian tradition, about which, I mean, you know, you can look that sort of stuff up in encyclopedias and dictionaries of spirituality or whatever if you want, and the kind of big names are easily accessible. And in a way, the main points are fairly easily accessible. Read Pseudo Dionysus, you know, on the mystical theology, and you've probably got most of it, really, and it's only about 5 pages long, so that, you know, it gives you enough to go on. So this is not that sort of exercise, but is a bit more focused. But I hope it nevertheless kind of answers the brief I was given. It's a general theme of many schools and traditions of mystical theology that whatever is experienced in the supreme moments of mystical experience, contemplation, union, whatever you call it, cannot readily be talked about. William James noted ineffability as one of the defining features of religious experience, and of course, generations of religious teachers have been saying the same thing for millennia. Either the one who's been to the top of the mountain and entered into the dazzling darkness of the divine must simply be silent as to what he or she has seen there, or else they can talk about it only in indirect or paradoxical expressions. What else can one expect? If God exists, and if God is even remotely what Jewish and Christian traditions have taught, there would seem to be a disparity between creature and creator, not to mention between sinner and holy one, that must make all human symbolic systems fall at the first hurdle. God is in heaven and we are on earth. Although the Bible does on occasion say that Moses talked with God face to face, it elsewhere says that the only view of God he was actually permitted to see was the divine backside, taking that term in its most vulgar understanding. However, in this paper, and that's the Bible, in this paper I want to step back from such sublime moments and suggest that, in an important sense, the apophatic moment of religious life, including under the rubric religious life what we might call the minds attending to God, begins much earlier, much further down the mountain, as it were. It begins, in fact, in the foothills, with the human being, him or herself. Before we can engage the riddle of an apophatic knowing of God, we must engage what have been called the apophatics of the human persona, a phrase I've just come across recently in a book I love, Therefore I Am, that Father Romulus brought to my attention. Of course, these are intimately connected, and in such a way that it's hard to imagine anyone having a sense for the ineffable mystery of God if they're not also alert to the dimension of ineffable mystery in each singular human life. And equally, it's hard to imagine someone who has a sense for the ineffable mystery of each singular human life being unable to grasp that, so far from signalling mere philosophical incoherence, to speak of what is mysterious, ineffable, unknowable, and unspeakable may be to speak of what is most important of all. I want to start with a classic but I think now generally neglected text on Christian mysticism, namely Dom Cuthbert Butler's 1922 book, Western Mysticism. Perhaps the date already gives us a clue as to why it has become neglected, since it speaks from within an era when scholars could quite comfortably talk about the mystical experience, or, as Butler does, about the objectivity of mystical experience, and do so in ways that subsequent generations have, for many good reasons, found hard to emulate. As Butler states it, the claim made by the mystics is that there is, quote, a conscious, direct contact of the soul with transcendental reality, capital T, capital R, a direct and objective intellectual intuition of transcendental reality, the establishing conscious relation with the absolute, the soul's possible union in this life with absolute reality. For Christians and theists, of course, according to Butler, the absolute, absolute being, absolute reality, transcendental reality, are God. And so the mystic's claim is expressed by Christian mystics as the experimental perception of God's presence and being, and especially union with God. A union that is not merely psychological, in conforming the will to God's will, but it may be said ontological, of the soul with God, spirit with spirit. Both philosophers and theologians will find much to quarrel with in these, to us, hopelessly naive formulations, and both might be amused by the abundance of capital letters with which Butler marks out his key terms. Kantians, for example, may think that a direct and objective intuition of transcendental reality is simply a contradiction in terms, and a failure to understand the difference between transcendental and transcendent anyway. Those who've read Heidegger's critique of the ontotheological foundation of metaphysics will be uneasy at the apparently unproblematic transfer of terms such as reality, or the absolute, to God. And theologians of various kinds will feel that this is all a bit too much like the God of the philosophers. Butler too, it should be said, was aware that, quote, much of the language used will hardly appear intelligible, and yet he was firmly convinced of the objective validity of the mystics' pronouncements, and set out to illustrate and expound the truths they describe. Whatever may be said for or against Butler's general concept of the mystical experience, capital T, capital M, capital E, one feature of his study is, I think, especially interesting. This is the way in which he finds a pattern in each of the main figures he discusses that he sums up, and remembering that this is a book about Western mysticism, that he sums up in the terms purgation, recollection, introversion, contemplation, and devotion. The key element here, I think, is that the mystic way, as he depicts it, necessarily involves and begins as a process in which the self turns in on itself, what Kierkegaard would call a self-relation that relates itself to itself. Here is what Butler says of Augustine. For Augustine, as for all true mystics, the indispensable condition of contemplation is such a purification of the soul as will render it fit for the ascent to the contemplation of God. But what does this mean? Purgation, and the ascetic discipline it involves, may, and perhaps mostly do, involve dealing with one or other aspect of the self's dealings with its world. But even when directed towards the regulation of outward habits or desires for external objects, they also have the character of a certain refocusing of the self itself, away from the world and towards itself. Even when it's merely a matter of giving up chocolate for Lent, the exercise is undertaken for the sake of disciplining the self. This is all the more evident, of course, when it comes to recollection and introversion. As Butler points out, quote, the word recollection is taken not in its present secondary sense of remembering, but in its primary sense of gathering together and concentrating the mind, Shutting off all external things from the mind and emptying it of distracting thoughts is the object of recollection, and such recollection is the prelude to that entering of the mind into itself which is effected by introversion, which is a concentration of the mind on its own highest or deepest part. Augustine's supreme account of this process, Butler says, and it's hard to disagree, is the meditation on memory as a means for finding God, as set out in Book 10 of the Confessions. Perhaps one of the greatest passages in all of Western Christian literature. Starting from the assumption that all knowledge is a form of recollection, and that we are never able to find anything unless in some way we already know what we're looking for, Augustine examines the contents of his memory to see where in it he has, as it were, stored the knowledge of the God his conscious mind had forgotten. But whilst he finds his memory replete with images of all manner of created beings, God is somehow not to be found. And so he concludes, "Where then did I find you, so that I could learn of you? For you were not in my memory before I learned of you. Where else then did I find you to learn of you, unless it was in yourself, above me?" A paradoxical outcome then, since in an important sense God turns out not to be in the memory, or to be in the memory only as a result of an encounter outside the memory and outside the human mind as such, in yourself, above me. The process of introversion is radically inconclusive, and discovers no ground of being imminent to consciousness, but rather, at the deepest or highest point of consciousness, debouches onto that which cannot be contained in consciousness and is necessarily and intrinsically external to it. Something that in the next section, 1027, Augustine will variously describe as beauty, a call, a taste, and a touch. Butler glosses this passage as affirming the simultaneous truth of the immanence and transcendence of God, calling in another well-known passage from the Confessions, in which Augustine speaks of God as being more inward to him than he is to himself. But whether we formulate the relationship in a more disjunctive or in a more harmonizing manner, the point seems to be that the self's possible knowledge of itself is not exhaustible in purely immanent categories, that, ultimately, the self cannot answer for itself, but its being what and as it is discoverable solely in terms of its God relationship. Butler finds an analogous account in the spiritual writings of Gregory the Great. Here he focuses especially on the transition from recollection to contemplation, from the human to the divine, a movement described in Gregory's allegorical interpretation of the book of Ezekiel. Pivotal is the image taken from Ezekiel's visions of the temple of Jerusalem of two doors facing each other. Butler quotes Gregory as follows. In the cognition of the Almighty God, our first door is faith, and our second is sight, to which, walking by faith, we arrive. For in this life we enter the door of faith, that afterwards we may be led to the other. And the door is opposite the door, because by the entrance of faith is opened the entrance of the vision of God. But if anyone wishes to understand both these doors, as of this life, this by no means runs counter to a sound meaning. For often we desire to contemplate the invisible nature of Almighty God, but we are by no means able. The soul, wearied by these difficulties, returns to itself, and uses itself as a ladder by which it may mount up, that first it may consider itself, if it is able, and then may explore, as far as it can, that nature which is above it. This, again, requires of the soul the practice of recollection, so that, quote, "When the soul, stripped of bodily images, is the object of its own thought, it has passed through the first door. But the way leads from this door to the other, that somewhat of the nature of Almighty God may be contemplated. And so the soul in the body is the life of the flesh, but God who gives life to all is the life of souls. and if life that is communicated is of such greatness that it cannot be comprehended, who will be able to comprehend by his intellect of how great majesty is the life that gives life? But to consider and grasp this fact is already, in some measure, to enter the second door. When the soul raised up to itself understands its own measure, and recognizes that it transcends all bodily things, and from the knowledge of itself passes to the knowledge of its Maker, what is this, except to see the door opposite the door? Now, there could be all sorts of fascinating things, of course, to say about these images of doors and liminalities and thresholds and transcendence and transgression, but I'm not particularly going to go into that just now. So again, the paradox that the soul that finds its deepest or highest point, the point of ultimate self-knowledge, simultaneously finds both that this is something that exceeds its capacities of comprehension, and that this mysterious discovery of its own deepest point has brought it into proximity to God. That passing through the door of the self, it finds itself at, or on the threshold of, the door to the contemplation of God. And of course, if what it comes to experience with regard to itself in such a moment is incomprehensible, so much the more, we may presume, will what it experiences of God be incomprehensible. Butler, as we've heard, will go on to argue that what is given in contemplation is a genuine and objective knowledge of God, or in theological terms, quote, that what is accepted by Christian belief as realities of faith in the case of all souls in a state of grace becomes consciously realized in the mystic vision. It involves hardly more than momentary liftings of the veil that keeps hidden from the mind's eye the soul's supernatural estate. It is an experimental perception of the presence of God in the soul, who at all times is there. I do not now want to argue this point, whether on theological, psychological, or philosophical grounds, but will rather follow the prompt given by Butler's emphasis on recollection and introversion as defining the path that leads to the mystic vision. As we've seen, whilst it might be possible to imagine an account of recollection that leads to some kind of fulfilling vision of the self at its culminating point, an account that seems to be supposed in some interpretations of Plato, the testimony of Augustine and Gregory has suggested two things. Firstly, that if there is some kind of fulfilling vision, it is found in some sense outside the self, or involves the self being taken beyond itself, from the one door to the other door. And secondly, beginning already in the furthest reaches of self-knowledge, or at the very liminal margins of self-knowledge, the concepts and categories by which we customarily understand ourselves and our world are radically shaken and overwhelmed. In such a perspective, the apophatic moment in the God relationship is preceded or anticipated by a similarly apophatic moment in our self-relationship. The way of self-knowledge leads to a certain kind of ignorance, and that ignorance becomes, if not a condition, then a characteristic of whatever knowledge of God we may go on to attain. If knowing God is not to know him, knowing ourselves by discovering the unknowable depths of the self is the primary preparation for such knowledge or non-knowledge. In this regard, the key dividing line with regard to knowledge is not to be drawn between divine and human, but falls within the human itself. Something which I think one can also find, incidentally, in Plotinus in the Ennead on the different kinds of being, where he draws the line precisely between being that is knowable according to nature and noetic being. That's very possibly some level in the background of a lot of this. In the early modern period, it seems that a sense for this unknowable dimension of the self was largely written out of both theological and anti-theological accounts of human selfhood. Of course, the psychological power of Lutheran and Protestant portrayals of the irrational depths of the human soul writhing in guilt before the unrelenting eyes of a judging God and crying out for a gracious, redeeming God did not offer anything like the contemplative vision of the self that Platonists, Christian and pagan, had sought. Nevertheless, although this was knowledge in a new key, it was offered as a sure and certain knowledge of how things really stood with the soul. It was frightful and awesome, sublime, but nevertheless a kind of knowledge. It was not apophatic. Catholic manuals of spiritual guidance offered similarly certain accounts, whilst Enlightenment psychologies prepared the ground for seeing the human being as machine man in Lemaître's phrase. It is, I suggest, primarily Kant, so often taken as public enemy number one by theological writers, who gave the impetus to a new kind of personalism by virtue of his emphasis on the noumenal and theoretically non-cognizable character of human freedom, and in this freedom saw not just an attribute but the ultimate point of reference, the defining point of reference for human selfhood. His German idealist heirs can variously be seen as either attempting to reincorporate this freedom into one or other system, or, perhaps especially in the case of Schelling, taking it as the basis for a thoroughly innovative exploration of the nature and destiny of human beings. Neither in Kant himself nor in his idealist heirs is this directly or essentially connected with the teaching of Christian mysticism, although a partial exception to this may be made in the case of Jakob Böhme, regarded by Hegel as the first German philosopher. However, this connection does return in the case of a number of 20th century personalist writers, writing, at the very least, in proximity to existentialism, both amongst Russian religious philosophers, for example, and such Catholic thinkers as Gabriel Marcel, in both cases, incidentally, with important background influence from both Kant and Schelling. Marcel wrote his doctoral thesis on Coleridge and Schelling, for example. However, the characteristically modern and post-Kantian emphasis on freedom significantly reshapes both the account of the mystery of the self and the way in which this account frames the interpretation of the God relationship and its apophatic dimension. It's typical of the personalist philosophers that they present their thought in a generally looser, more essayistic or even aphoristic manner than is standard in modern philosophical literature. I'm afraid Julia's heard this bit of the paper before, but maybe she's forgotten it. Anyway, Berdyaev was himself highly conscious of not writing and not wanting to write in a rigorous or systematic way, and he rarely addresses in any detail what often look like inconsistencies or unargued leaps in his thought, nor is he a close reader of texts. He himself regarded the systematic form and the kind of rigour that he saw in Husserlian phenomenology as unsuited to dealing with human spiritual freedom. It's therefore not hard to pick out significant inconsistencies in Berdyaev's thought. A case in point concerns his vacillations, as we might call them, with regard to the question of freedom and being. At some points he will insist that freedom cannot have its source in being, nor be determined by being, although he also speaks of the human being's original participation in the mystery of being that enables us to apprehend being. Yet there is a clear continuity in the kind of emphasis he places on freedom and the kind of conclusions he draws from his claims regarding the primacy of freedom, not least concerning philosophy's ability to deal adequately with the depths of human personality, depths that Berdyaev believes are rooted and grounded in an abyssal freedom for which there can ultimately be no rational explication. In a sense, and for reasons which will become clear, it seems to me a secondary question for Berdyaev whether this abyss is appropriately spoken of in terms of being, even though he can on at least one occasion say that the question what is being is the fundamental problem of philosophy, a statement one might have thought that would make it rather important to be clear as to the applicability of the term to human personhood. The limits of philosophy in general are frequently mentioned in Berdyaev's works. In Spirit and Reality, for example, he says of Fichte and the German idealists that their ontology produces only an objectified concept and an understanding of being that's limited to being that's susceptible of conceptualization and rationalization. However, he says, the impetus towards such objectification and rationalization had already been given by the Greeks and is also effective in Thomism. Hegel is praised for having attempted to put life into numbed and ossified being and for developing a dialectic that could do justice to real life. Nevertheless, Hegel's fixation on objectivity proves ultimately limiting, and the outcome of his dialectic is a system that is monistic and impersonal. Even the latest versions of ontology, Berdyaev mentions Heidegger, fail to give expression to the depths of existence, and so end in nihilism and pessimism. The mystery of reality is not solved by concentrating on the object, Berdyaev writes, but by reflecting on the subject. I shall come back to Berdyaev's understanding of subjectivity, but in the comments about the limitations of philosophy just cited, we can see that he closely associates philosophy and ontology. The error of philosophy is precisely a certain prioritizing of being that fails to attend to certain features of real existence. This Berdyaev thinks is especially fatal in the closely connected case of God and spirit. He applauds apophatic theology for denying being to God. He writes, "Negative theology recognizes that there is something higher than being. God is not being. Knowledge of being is not the last thing, nor the first." But what's wrong with being? As some of the comments we've already heard indicate, being privileges the unchangeable over what is dynamic and living. Typically, it appears in philosophy in the numbed and ossified forms that Hegel criticized, or, as Berdyaev elsewhere puts it, as congealed being. Being is, in fact, not something of which we have any experience. It is a construct in which we impose our human limitations on a reality that is always richer, greater, and more vital than our words and concepts are able to grasp. A science of being leads only to a concept of the absolute as the boundary of abstract thought. But the absolute, which incidentally has no possible relation to any significant other, there is no otherness in relation to the absolute, according to Berdyaev, is not the God of the Bible. Instead of seeking to ground ontology in objectivity, we would do better, Berdyaev says, to turn to subjectivity, existence, spirit, freedom, and personality, terms which for Berdyaev are pretty well synonymous. A philosophy that did this would no longer be a philosophy of being. The philosophy of spirit should not be a philosophy of being or an ontology, but a philosophy of existence. And it would be an error to identify spirit and being. Spirit is freedom, creativeness. Spirit exercises a primacy over being, the primacy of freedom. Consequently, existential philosophy is not ontological philosophy in the traditional sense of the word. Berdyaev thus presents us with two very different kinds of philosophy between which he says we must choose. That is, between the philosophy which acknowledges the primacy of being over freedom and the philosophy which recognizes the supremacy of freedom over being. Berdyaev, of course, chooses the latter. Freedom, he says, is without foundation. It is not determined by being nor born of it. There is no compact, uninterrupted being. There are breaks, fractions, abysses, paradoxes. There are transcensions. There exists, therefore, only freedom and personality. And a personality, he adds, that personality is outside of all being. It stands in opposition to being. Its principle is dissimilarity. Important aspects of freedom, personality to emphasize here, are creativeness and the concomitant possibility of genuine novelty, the occurrence of a new thing, and the uniqueness of each personal existence. Each personal existence is something new in nature, that never has been before and never will be again. Personality is the exception, not the rule. The secret of the existence of personality lies in its absolute irreplaceability, its happening but once, its uniqueness, its incomparableness. But personality is not only a new thing in itself, it's also possessed of the freedom to bring forth something new in the world, to act creatively. A personal existence is not simply a new phenomenon that has never been seen before, but an existence that lives by being constantly productive of novelty. Yet, on the plane of our common experience of history, it seems possible to find explanations for and to construct taxonomies for classifying human behaviour, even if one doesn't go so far as to suppose the existence of unalterable historical or sociological laws. The time in which the creative novelty of each singular personal life exists, therefore, is therefore not the horizontal or objectified time running from past to present to future, a sequence of events crying out for explanation by history. Rather, it's what in his work The Meaning of History, Berdyaev calls superhistory, which he later calls existential time, time that happens in the vertical and not the horizontal. This is why, he says, the true time of existence is apocalyptic time, for time is not the image of eternity. Famous phrase from Plato, of course, time is the moving image of eternity. Time is eternity that has collapsed in ruins. Only in the prism of eschatological existence can contemporary existence become meaningful and fulfilled, a thought that, however differently argued, was concurrently in the 1920s being developed by, for example, Tillich, and in a more secular key, by Heidegger. It's from the perspective of eschatological existence that it becomes possible for Berdyaev to speak more ironically about being, as when in a rather late work, Solitude and Society, he describes the personality as immersed in being. Here it seems the depths of existence are effectively identified with immersion in being, and religion said to be man's revealed life, his life in the depths of being. We must affirm the primacy of integral man, he asserts, of man rooted in the very heart of being, as against the consciousness of the confrontation of subject and being. At this level, a kind of philosophy becomes possible whose sine qua non is the intuition of being, albeit an intuition that cannot find any single adequate objective form. Here it seems that taking the part of the subject against being would already be to accede to a derogation of the original power of existence. Rather, the existential subject is a part of being, and being itself is thereby shown to be internally differentiated, as when Berdyaev speaks of a transcendence of being operative in the heart of being. Whether we understand this as marking a real development in Berdyaev's thought or as a way of saying the same thing otherwise is debatable. In either case, one might consider, for example, the constant role of a certain reading of Jacob Boehmer refracted through his incorporation into Schellingian philosophy, and Berdyaev's embrace of a view of superhistory or apocalyptic time as a non-objective process that is both theogonic, God's own self-production out of the Beemian abyss or Ungrund, and incarnational, as a process occurring concretely in the event of divine humanity. In relation to the constant inspiration of this powerful vision, the philosophical vocabulary is, we might say, secondary. If we don't say it, Berdyaev will say it for us. Or, precisely because ontology is not primary, the insistence on a certain ontological doctrine, positive or negative, as the case may be, can never be the main thing. Spiritual existence can be communicated only in myth and symbol, not in concepts. Two further features of Berdyaev's thought are important to note before I move on to Marcel. The first is that the privileging of subjectivity is not to be equated with individualism. As opposed to the thinking eye of Descartes or the universal eye of Fichte that sees the other only in terms of the non-I, personality is from the beginning open to the other, whom it also experiences as another I or as a thou. Quote, the vision of another person's countenance, the expression of his eyes, offers more than a set of data to be interpreted, but is, or is potentially, a spiritual experience. But it's not only a question of a relationship of I and thou, as opposed to that of I and it, as for Buber. It's also for Berdyaev a we, a communion in the spirit, for which he invokes the Russian term savornost, a communion in which the uniqueness of each participant is not subordinated to any universal ontology or ethic. This is precisely a community that belongs to superhistory, to existential or apocalyptic time, a community of transhistorical memory that is always still to be realized, the memory, if you like, of what we shall be. This is both the open horizon into which the concrete encounter with the face of the other opens up, and also that community that can only become actual in that same encounter. The second, closely connected with this, is that although Berdyaev often adopts a highly dualistic rhetoric, as we've heard, it's not a dualism that requires rejecting or denigrating the body. The flesh to which the New Testament opposes the life of the spirit is not to be equated with the physical body, but with sin, a point that Berdyaev sees as especially clear in the assertion that the only unforgivable sin is the sin against the spirit. Spirit is not only divine, it is also divinely human, divinely worldly, and the process of theogony is inseparable from the concrete existence in the world of divine enfleshed humanity. It is the face of the other and the light in the eyes of the other that calls me to assume the spiritual responsibility towards that face and that light, and in doing so, preeminently to discover what it means to exist as freedom and as spirit. And one last comment. Precisely because, or to the extent that what we're dealing with here is a matter of freedom, there can be no guarantees as to a happy ending. Berdyaev's thought is expressly tragic, or potentially tragic. On the plane of historical time, we will never see the kingdom of God, although in this same historical time, we are always free to begin once more to seek it. As I mentioned earlier, there's a significant convergence between Berdyaev's thought and that of other contemporary personalist thinkers, perhaps especially Gabriel Marcel. For Marcel, however, who's far more of a kind of harmonizing spiritual personality, it's not so much a matter of contrasting the realm of the personal with the realm of being as of deepening the realm of being until it opens out into the realm of the personal. Transcendence itself is integral to our experience of being, according to Marcel. Experience is always more than mere experience, and in varying degrees is saturated with an intelligibility that exceeds what can be made into an object of empirical investigation, or else has a kind of purity that evokes a sense of transcendence. We always associate now the kind of expression saturated phenomenon with Jean-Luc Marion, but Marcel's actually using it 50 years ago. But this, 60 actually, sorry. The same experience is always primarily self-experience. Its existence as manifesting itself in me, even in such simple cases as the child whose whole life, according to Marcel, seems to cry out, "Here I am, what luck," which Marcel calls a kind of exclamatory awareness of oneself. But this is, so it's the kind of jouissance of a child is the first sort of mode of self-experience. But this is also an experience of existing that is at the same time entirely bodily, only not the body as a possession or an instrument of the self, still less, of course, the body that exists as the object of physiological investigation, but the body that I myself am, the lived, mysterious, felt reality of my being in the world, the inseparability of body and self in child consciousness, for example. It's solely as embodied beings, as beings who do not exist otherwise than as embodied, that in, with, and under our experience of beings, we also experience the exigency of being, which conversely requires us to attend to become open to, and give ourselves to the other beings in which being is disclosed to us. We do not, as it were, first experience being, and then add to that the claims made upon us by other beings, but we first experience being in that very claim itself. For Marcel, this means that the claims of intersubjectivity are also the claims of love, the call to exist as other than a subjective being for itself, which is, of course, primary for Sartre, with whom Marcel is often kind of implicitly dialoguing in many of his writings. As he puts it, love is the active refusal to treat itself as subjective. Our basic experience of being is therefore relational, or, in Marcel's preferred term, participatory. I concern myself with being, he says, only insofar as I have a more or less distinct consciousness of the unity which ties me to the other beings of whose reality I already have a preliminary notion. It's in this spirit that he interprets contemplation not as an act of withdrawing the mind from the external world, as recommended in some of the treatises of the Western mystical tradition that we've heard from, but as a kind of focusing of the lived reality of the world. Quote, "To contemplate is to ingather oneself in the presence of whatever is being contemplated, and this in such a fashion that the reality confronting which one ingathers oneself itself becomes a factor in the ingathering." I don't think that's offered as a kind of interpretation of the idea of Ereignis that Heidegger's developing at this time, but I think it could usefully serve to interpret it. Marcel nicely condenses the distinctiveness of this approach from that of Sartre when he says that my being is disclosed to me not primarily as pour soi, but as chez soi. I'm not a being for myself who can only then problematically come into relation to other beings, but I'm first of all a being that exists as a readiness to receive the other in one's own prepared place of reception. For Marcel, it's further axiomatic that this ontological exigency of a basic openness to the other, self-transcendence, is at its deepest, properly experienced also as the exigency of God. The exigency of God, he says, is simply the exigency of transcendence, already implicit in our experience of being in our relations to others, disclosing its true face. Summing up thus far, Marcel thus offers a sequence of mutually participatory dimensions of being, such that the basic possibility of experiencing myself at all, my basic feeling of myself as being here, in this body, as this body, now, this moment, already involves me in an implicit relation to others, and in that relation to others also exposes me to the exigency of love, which in turn is the human form of the exigency of God. To know myself as being, in the fullest sense, is therefore achievable only to the extent that I am able to affirm the presence of the other and the presence of God as integral to my presence to myself and my presence in the world. As Marcel says, with specific reference to the other human person, when somebody's presence does really make itself felt, it reveals me to myself. It makes me more fully myself than I should be if I were not to be exposed to this impact. And as he immediately adds, all of this, of course, is very difficult to express in words. I cannot learn how to experience the presence of others by any kind of technique, and perhaps still less can I learn how to make my own presence present to others. For Marcel, there can be no such thing as charm school. He says that explicitly. Presence is not reducible to a technique or an object. It can only be glimpsed, invoked, or evoked, and is essentially magical. Or, in terms that gave the lectures their title, it is experienceable only as mystery. So if Berdyaev on the whole insists on the duality of spirit and world, Marcel more characteristically sees the movement of transcendence that ultimately leads us into the presence of God as already implicit in our ordinary everyday experience of the world. Yet, there's also a significant congruence between their philosophies. Both insist on the centrality of human personality in a properly religious approach to God. For both of them, the question of God is not a question to which an account of what is the case, whether that's understood metaphysically or historically, could ever give a satisfactory answer, but is meaningless unless it is set in the horizon of free personal responsibility. As such, it is a question that only really arises for a subject who lives out of his or her spiritual possibilities, and it's only properly addressed when or to the extent that we understand it as requiring a free personal response. Proof, evidence, and persuasion are simply not to the point. Sorry, Professor Swinburne. Berdyaev's polemic against philosophy, Greek, Latin, and German, is unambiguous. God is neither a possible object of knowledge in any philosophical system, nor the object of any positive science. Even if myth and symbol may be regarded as appropriate forms for expressing the overflowing reality of the divine life, or more precisely, the divinely human life that is the actual revelation of God, the interpretation of these is dependent on the free activity of the interpreter. Myth and symbol are suggestive rather than binding. Marcel, on the other hand, sees what he is doing as philosophy. And yet it is philosophy that culminates in mystery. And to repeat, it is in a sense in the domain of mystery from the beginning. The basic experience of the child's awakening to life in the world is already mysterious. And the mystery only deepens as we pass on to the freedom of responsible adult life, and from there move into the mystery of aging, looking all the while towards the ultimate mystery of God. It's therefore far from coincidental that Marcel was a dramatist as well as a philosopher, that his philosophical work frequently alludes to his own and to other works of literature. In their consistent attention to the limits of knowledge in relation to spiritual life, both therefore reenact the tropes of apophatic theology in the context of a post-Kantian tradition that sees mystery as already present in the existential life of the living human being. Of course, the generation of Berdyaev and Marcel may already seem very remote to those who have been reared on a diet of postmodernism. Their faith in human personality seems not to have taken account of the death of the self widely reported from the 1960s onwards. Nevertheless, and there could be all sorts of kind of textual details put in here, but they would be a bit boring. Nevertheless, I think that they provide a helpful bridge from the world of post-Kantian philosophy back to a still earlier tradition, the tradition represented in Butler's Western mysticism, and they provide a hermeneutical key for unlocking much of what's still valuable in that tradition, not least, and that's our focus this afternoon, the sense that the mystery of God is somehow bound up with the mystery of the self, and that an apophatic theology is ultimately inseparable from an apophatics of the human person. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for a very engaging and deeply interesting paper, I thought. So, the format of these things is there's been a sort of Hindu response, which has always been very difficult. Because, I mean, in everything you've said, there are points of contact and points of dissimilarity within different thinkers in different periods of the history of Hinduism. So, but a number of things I thought one of in the early part of your paper there was you were talking about interiority and subjectivity, and I thought that was had a lot of parallels with some yoga traditions, for example, where you have an intensification of interiority and an intensification of subjectivity, which actually linked in with the point of Burjayev that you mentioned, where he separates individuality from subjectivity. I think it was very insightful, because it seems to me that in the Indian traditions, and also I think it's true of ascetic traditions generally, an intensification of subjectivity is precisely going away from individuality, in a sense. But that intensification of subjectivity is simultaneously an opening out to transcendence, in a way. Mm-hmm. And that you form the self in the shape of tradition, as it were. So, you take on a different name and you undergo ascetic practices. Now, that eradication of individuality is also an intensification of subjectivity, it seems to me, which is linked, as you were saying, to this idea of something transcendent within us, as it were. The second point was the stripping of images that you mentioned, and in Berjayev and others, God not being an object of consciousness. I thought that was interesting, if God could be an object of consciousness. In yoga traditions, you have the idea that there's a subject of consciousness and the object of consciousness, a bit like Husserlian phenomenology, and you have to sort of distance yourself, or you detach yourself from the objects of consciousness. And certainly in the Yoga Sutras, Ishvara, God, seems to be an object of consciousness, and that's an interesting sort of idea there. But the self cannot be, in a sense, an object of consciousness. So that language of the participation in the mystery of being, Berger's language of the participation in the mystery of being, I'm not sure that you would get precisely that in the Indian tradition. Although perhaps implicitly there, you do have that sort of a Upanishadic idea, perhaps. So I'm slightly hesitant about making these parallels, but I think that there are some suggestive links here. And also the paradox, if you like, the paradox of the self, the paradox of the self as knowledge. I mean, most Indian traditions, philosophical traditions, state jnana, knowledge, as a feature of the self. And yet also there's this idea, if the self is knowledge, how can the self be beyond knowledge, beyond expressibility? How can the self be an object if knowledge entails... If knowledge entails a subject or an object of consciousness, and that knowledge is something associated with the object, how can the self be its own object? So, and lastly, I don't think in Hinduism there's no sovanost in Hinduism as you have in Brajya, so I think there's another big difference there. But anyway, there's just a few general comments. So let's open it up to questions and comments. One from the back there.
First of all, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure it was such a pleasure to hear the paper. Can I ask a slightly tangential question, perhaps? It's a useful way of looking upon the self as a mystery, as mysterious, perhaps commensurate with the mystery of the divine person, the divine personal being. And if it helped the author to put the other person as relational, i.e. open, alert towards other personal existences. What is it that, how can we define that unique person? What is it that makes each person unique? Or, to pay tribute to Professor Swinburne, what is it that makes me today the same person as yesterday and the same one as will be, for example, in this catalogical fulfillment?
The big question is, should I comment on what you said before? I suppose some of these differences, I mean, do have to do, don't they, with in a way, simply context. That both Berdyaev and Marcel are very much engaged in a series of running debates with a lot of contemporary or near contemporary philosophical positions. So what they say about knowledge, for example, needs to be assessed in terms of the prevailing models of knowledge in their time, whether those are coming from German idealism or Marxism or positive science, and the kind of split in the modern Western world, with the increasing self-confidence and success of the kind of ideal of knowledge as science in the 19th century, as to whether then the word knowledge that might be used in religious traditions, you know, even if we want to still go on using it, it clearly doesn't mean the same thing as the sort of knowledge that's the result of a major research project with a multi-billion pound laboratory turning out outcomes and so on and so forth. So you can kind of use it if you like, and I think part of their reaction against knowledge is partly to do with that, you know, changing history of knowledge as well. And again, I mean, the sort of questions of subjectivity and the particular way in which issues of subjectivity and objectivity are set up in German idealism, and the sort of aspiration of people like Fichte that, as it were, there can be an intellectual intuition in which the circle is completed, and that the founding active principle has insight into its own ontological basis and thereby secures its insights as knowledge. So they're also but thereafter subjectivity and objectivity are always correlative to each other, to insist either on the one or the other is also to have the other in play, and I think they're both in their different ways wanting to kind of break that, which sort of kind of comes to Julia's points. I mean, I think you used the word commensurate, and I don't think either of them would use that word.
I have another right in mind, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
I mean, I think the word that Marcel repeatedly uses is exigence, you know, the exigency of being, that our relation to being revealed in the face of the other is, you know, in some ways, of course, it's very like what's perhaps more familiar today in terms of Levinas's infinite demand. It is, although it's not as it were as... it's all a bit more friendly in Marcel's philosophy, you know, it's not so unrelentingly demanding as in Levinas, it's also receiving a gift in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it is being open and attentive to and receptive to and engaged by and engaged with that exigence as it comes in real time. And I think precisely for that reason, your Swinburnian question.
I'm not a fan of that.
No, it's a bona fide question. I mean, in a sense, becomes sort of turned round, because there can be no assurance as to the continuity of the self outside the exigency of love. It is always possible, and certainly in a Christian concept where sin is taken very seriously, that I might ruin myself, that I might become a war criminal, that I might go around shooting Jews in the back of the head. And, you know, as some of those who did that sort of thing said afterwards, how can we bear to go on living? I might destroy. We have, and I think for Berdyaev too, there is a, you know, freedom is a terrifying thing. And it was, I think it was potentially, although, you know, very different rhetorics from Sartre, but potentially as terrifying as for Sartre, that we are free to ruin our lives. And that therefore it is in a sense, I mean, it's again, of course, it's neither Marcel or Berdyaev phrase, it is a kind of bad faith, in a sense, to rest one's hopes for one's personal identity on a kind of objective or subpersonal argument that is not constantly being tested against the kind of exigence of being in love, I'd say.
I mean, just a further question beyond that, but just to kind of piggyback, how then would that kind of tie into the Christian understanding of promise? That if there is this kind of angst that kind of comes with possibilities that things could really go wrong, how does I guess Berdyaev kind of square that with the promise that no, things are going to be better?
Yeah, well, I mentioned in the paper that I'm in bed. Berdyaev certainly speaks about his thought as tragic.
Yeah.
Marcel also, and there's an anthology of his writings under the title The Tragic Wisdom. Mm-hmm. I think, and of course a complex and difficult debate then sets in as to how far Christianity can be a tragic view of life. And whether a tragic view of life or even countenancing the possibility of ultimate tragedy is compatible. I'm just repeating your question back to you, really, of course, is compatible with the promise of Christian faith. But I think that for certainly for Berdyaev, and I imagine for Marcel as well, I mean, the possibility of tragedy doesn't mean that it is a tragedy, because the dialectic of, perhaps not the best word, or the relationship between tragedy and hope is one in which freedom, spiritual existence, life has a part to play. There are no predetermined outcomes, and in a sense whether the outcome is tragic or not is an issue for freedom, an issue for exigence. But simply to kind of say it'll all come right in the end is to kind of fluff it, I think. From their point of view, it is not to take seriously the exigence, if you like, the sacrament of the present moment. It's not our job to be looking beyond what is actually being demanded of us in our existential situation, and to make, I suppose another way of putting it, which I think both of them kind of do touch on this sort of issue of participant-observer, that in a sense that, you know, existential philosophy is not philosophy developed from the point of view of the observer, sub specie aeternitatis kind of thing, but is philosophy that's opened only to those who are participant in what's going on. And qua participants, we're not in a position to kind of know if it's a comedy or a tragedy. That's only something that becomes visible from the point of view of the external spectator.
That links in with Dostoevsky's point, in a way, that the if everything comes together in some grand thing at the end of time, it wouldn't be worth the baby on the end of the bayonet kind of thing.
Well, Dostoevsky's character Ivan, anyway.
Yes.
Of course, Berdyaev is soaked in Dostoevsky. I mean, he's an absolutely central point of reference. He wrote a book on Dostoevsky in which he had the kind of wonderful line that the existence of Dostoevsky justifies the whole history of Russia. something like that. Is that something like that, isn't it? And that, you know, when at the last judgment the nations of the world are kind of summoned before the heavenly throne, you know, the Russians will be able to say, Dostoevsky. Don't look at Stalin. But
Stalin was Georgian anyway.
Of course. How could I forget? Yeah.
Thank you. I think this is probably a very naive question, because the traditions you're talking about are new to me in many ways. and I'm not even sure if it was PJF or Marcel, because it's just at the transition in the paper between the two, but you quoted one or glossed one as saying that experience had to be understood as self-experience.
Mm.
And I wasn't sure how it could be otherwise.
Well, there are philosophical traditions that think or think we are to a high degree capable of abstracting from ourself and even not beginning with ourself, and so it's therefore quite important for them in philosophical traditions, or that even if we start with ourselves, we are able to find some kind of objective point beyond, which I mean one might take as a sort of fairly simplistic reading of Descartes, and that, you know, clearly we start with reflection on the self, but what he believes he arrives at through that is something that is kind of fixed and objective and thereafter, in a sense, independent of the self, and he can go off and do mathematics and map the universe mathematically without further reference back to the, as it were, the subjective self-experience of the self. But I think for Berdyaev and Marcel and for other existential philosophers, it's crucial that actually, you know, we can all maybe relatively abstract from that. And even if the relatively kind of goes as far as that, it's still only relatively, it still remains in some ways within the gravitational field of our ongoing self-experience, whether that's thought of as individually or communally.
So in some sense it starts there and has to remain there.
Yes, and always, in a sense, keep coming coming back there as well, you know. And I mean, in a sense, one could say, you know, I'm following from Descartes and others in the 17th century, there is this kind of great creation of a scientific and technological world that we are now sort of seeing deploying its fullest powers, but then there also has to be a sort of return on the question, well, you know, is all of this doing us any good, or what good is it doing, and what is being human in relation to this thing that, in a sense, we have created?
But on the level of experience, it seems that would always have to be navigated through taking the subject in some sense not all of existence necessarily, but experience would seem to have to require that gravitational pull, as you say.
But I think in the period they're living, I mean, you know, Michael's been doing work on some of this sort of utopianism of the early 20th century. I mean, both within the Marxist paradigm and within the sort of Western, both Christian and non-secular paradigms, that there are extraordinary fantasies, in a sense, that very widely spread in society, that, you know, we can, as there are again today, that we can sort of leave who we are behind, that what have been thought of as human realities and human needs are, you know, can just be sort of sorted and dealt with. In terms of the relationship between the two, I mean, I think myself, although I haven't kind of documented this, but I mean, Berdyaev was exiled after the revolution and lived in Paris from the 1920s onwards and was very closely associated there. He knew personally a great many of these sort of French philosophers and thinkers, and I'm pretty sure he would have known Marcel personally. And I think that probably his move to a more tolerant attitude, if you like, to talking about being might be partly understandable in terms of an implicit dialogue with Marcel and the recognition of a certain kind of sympathy between their two thoughts, really, and to kind of say that, well, you know, this might be another way of saying what I want to say. They're certainly very much by the 1930s, 40s, both working in very much the same sort of thought world. And both being received then in the English-speaking world very much in the same, you know, their transition into the English-speaking world in the 1940s is pretty synchronous, really, and they start to get translated and appearing in English and becoming influential and recognised in the English-speaking world at the same time. So in the late 1940s, Marcel is giving the Gifford lectures as Berdyaev is receiving an honorary doctorate from Cambridge, only the second Russian to have that. Tchaikovsky having been the other. Both died about 6 months later. I don't know if any Russians have accepted honorary doctorates from Cambridge since. Beware if you're Russian.
Berdyaev also somewhere claims that creative freedom is not just a privilege but also a duty.
Mm.
Do you think that from the point of view of Christianity is a bit austere or stern? Because he also claims that God does not need unfree human person.
Well, I mean, I actually think that's very liberating. I mean, because I think one of the difficult paradigms, really, certainly of Western religious thought since the Enlightenment, has been that, you know, it's really a zero-sum game. Either all the freedom is on God's side and we have nothing, or all the freedom is on our side and God doesn't exist. And the latter, Sartre, would be the most obvious example of the latter, and I suppose a certain kind of ultra-Calvinism would be the example of the former. And in many ways, I think these assumptions continue actually to pervade, you know, very contemporary discussions about faith schools and the place of religion in society, and that if religion is allowed any scope, it will automatically become heteronomous, and that religion is necessarily opposed to human autonomy, and so on. And recently, well, Gavin mentioned my book on art, and I mean, I take issue with one of my Christchurch colleagues, Peter Conrad, his book on creation, gods, or whatever, where he sort of says that in a sense the modern artist has taken over the role of God in Genesis 1 and become the world creator, whereas Christianity only allows God to be creative, but the modern artist has, as it were, wrested this creative freedom away from God. But Berdyaev, as you know, one of his early books was on the meaning of the creative act. I mean, says quite otherwise. Says if human beings are made in the image of God, and if God is creative, then of course human beings are creative. The creativity of human beings is far from being, as it were, an act of autonomous defiance or rebellion against God, but is precisely fulfilling one of God's greatest gifts to us. And I think this emphasis on creativeness is actually a very important thing in Berdyaev as well, because I think a lot of modern debates about the limits of autonomy, if you like, are set up in terms of ethics. But I think the question of creativeness and creativity is just as important in a way there for human flourishing. So I mean, I think in a sense that sort of course if one would rather just lie in bed, or if one kind of sits at the typewriter and, sorry, that's showing my age, sits at the laptop, can't be bothered, I mean, then it is hard, it is demanding, of course, and creativeness isn't just kind of slopping the paint all over the place. But
can we not presume that this verse from the New Testament, "Be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect," is just a kind of a nucleus of personalism in Christianity? Like in dynamic imperative in Christianity.
So I think it would be true for both the people we're discussing, and perhaps for Christianity generally, that of course, in a sense, this is process, not. And again, it is precisely in the form of sort of exigence, be perfect, not you are perfect, and you merely have to unfold your perfection, as it were, but this is a demand, a challenge. But even the demand and challenge, and perhaps Marcel would emphasize this more than Berdyaev, even though the demand and the challenge might be demanding and even be experienced as hard by a human being, the very fact that it is experienced as a demand and a challenge means that it's experienced in the context of a relationship. And that to experience the demand, no matter how demanding, is already to be in some kind of relationship to the God who, in a sense, is the end point of the demand, so that we are always already having been brought into that relationship in some way, the divine gift, no matter how invisibly or unnoticed, therefore always kind of precedes and grounds the possibility of our striving, so that we're not, as it were, just kind of thrown into the swimming pool and kind of said, swim.
What are your thoughts on how, in this kind of apophatic consideration, the cataphatic experience kind of comes through and has interplay with it?
Well, I mean, theologians, of course, always want to kind of put in a good word for cataphatic theology, because if we couldn't do that, we'd be out of business. and, of course, that's true also of Dionysus, or already and all the way through the Christian tradition, and there are different sort of mixes. I mean, I like the way, and you might know Michael Sell's book. What's the title of it?
Languages of
I'm saying, yeah. And he talks something about kind of apophatic markers, and says one of the kind of things, if you look at theological texts in a sense, in a quasi-literary point of view, you know, look at the density, if you like, of the apophatic markers. I mean, there are an awful lot of theologies where somewhere in the introduction the theologian will say, of course, we cannot really know anything of God because God is God, and then they go on to kind of give you 600 pages of what they know about God, expounding doctrine, Trinity, incarnation, the rest of it. Other theologies kind of mention it every other sentence or construct formulations or sentences that are constantly paradoxical and challenging the mind and creating difficulties for the reader. So, and Sell's book kind of looks both at Jewish, Islamic and Christian traditions, and clearly within each of these one can find texts that are either more apophatic, more cataphatic. And I think what's interesting about him is it also the way in which, you know, apophatic theology isn't just flagged by the fact that someone says somewhere we can't know God as he is in himself, as Aquinas says, but by the way in which the theology is then written and the very kind of writing of it, and whether it perhaps comes is written as poetry or as you know, the sort of paradoxical formulations of a Kierkegaard or an Eckhart, according to era. But of course, even, well, maybe not, I mean, there may be, but who would know? And there may be those apophatic theologians who are simply saying nothing and have never said anything to anyone, but we don't know who they are. Maybe in India they know who they are, and they say, he went off 30 years ago and has never said anything since. You can go and look at him not saying anything, but that would be, I suppose, one limit. But just about anyone else has to say something. And I think for Marcel, I mean, of course, a thoroughgoing Westerner in many ways, and that's right, because we are always already in relationship to one another. You know, we're born out, we come out of the body of another human being. We couldn't survive a week without being held and looked after and fed by other human beings. We're always in relation to other human beings, and, you know, I'd go with Heidegger that language, logos, is one of the basic means of human being in the world. We are not in the world other than as beings that have logos, and even pretty small babies, once their eyes begin to focus, are immediately also in some way or other within logos, even if that, you know, for the first few months a whole load of nonsense talk to them. So we must be communicative. We can't not be communicative. But there are limits.
Can I push you a bit on, at the very end you say the mystery of God is kind of crazy of your papers, the mystery of God is somehow bound up with the mystery of the person. Other places you say it's the necessary precondition, you know, so this kind of transcendent relation of the subject, you know, itself and the other is somehow bound up. And is it analogous, so that there the kind of two should meet, that the forms are similar, or is it, you know, or maybe even someone like Luber, you might say there's a kind of mutuality, or even maybe with some of Levinas, that you would say that no, that the actual transcendent relationship is precisely with the other or the other person. What is, how are those two related?
I think I said near the beginning that it would be difficult, wouldn't it, to imagine, I mean, if a person is aware of what, for the kind of sake of shorthand, one might call the sort of apophatics of the person or the mystery of personal being. Then you might talk to them and they say, well, actually, you know, I'm not very interested in religion and, you know, I don't kind of, none of this stuff about God makes any sense to me. But it's kind of hard to imagine that if they really did have a living sense of the mystery of being, that they would be, as it were, totally dogmatically hostile to religion, even if the forms in which they encountered religion were, as it were, forms that made religion seem very dogmatic and certain of itself and by no means apophatic. So, I mean, if a person who has a sort of sense of the apophatics of the person encounters a strongly cataphatic form of theology, it's kind of likely to be off-putting, but it would be hard to imagine that such a person would be totally closed off, as it were, to a kind of deeper or more adequate articulation of religion and vice versa. But I mean, I think the sorts of mixes that you then come up with are about as diverse as human beings. So I mean, I know that that's not what you were asking me, and you were asking me to provide some kind of ground model that would, in a sense, work for all, as to whether, as it were, you know, I mean, Buber seems to say that every encounter with the other, the divine other, is all in some sense implicit within it, or whether there is an encounter with the divine other that is sui generis, that is distinctive from. So, I think Marcel and Berdyaev wouldn't want to allow that, really, because even if at some ineffable level there is, let's say, a sense of the presence of God or a sense of the mystery of God that can be thematized in some way in distinction from our experience of other people, from the ethical demand, from the exigency of love, then if you spend too much time thematizing it, or if you're going to immediately start to distract yourself from the primary locus of your of the human the human place, but where the exigency of love is normally and for the most part, you know, in New Testament terms, how can you say you love God whom you've not seen if you don't love the neighbour whom you have seen? Now it may be that, you know, in loving the neighbour you're loving God, but if you then spend too much time banging on about how you're loving God when you love the neighbour gradually sort of disappears from sight, which I think both of them would see as problematic. And I think in the Christian context they'd be right to do so, though.
What do you do when you say, like, Habermas, you know, he's all for it, but, you know, he says, I don't have a musical ear.
Yes.
In his two-hour discussion with the Pope.
Well, I think the sort of, and that musical image is a good one, I think. I mean, I've become quite taken recently with the sort of French philosopher Yankelevich, who's also a musicologist, and he's very much kind of writing in some ways in the same sort of thought world as these two. And he speaks sort of rather apophatically in a way, but also in a rather Marcel-like way about the possibility of God. But he refers to it sometimes as the melody. In a sense, the thing that you can't pin down, that's always there. I mean, you know, in a musical piece you've got all the notes, and of course there are some musicians who can play all the notes in a piece and it sounds terrible, because they don't give you the melody. The notes may all be correct, but it doesn't make the music musical. And that it is that sort of constantly present, as it were, musicality or joie de vivre of divine presence that's the thing. But of course it's only it never emerges separately from the mass of notes, as it were, and you can't, it is, well, he uses what, which Marcel also uses, for example, charm. The American concept of a charm school is something that Marcel can, because he's French, charme is something new. Some women, of course, are charming, but others not, and what can you do about it? It's that it's kind of, you know, the possibility of the God relationship is in the air all the time. It's sort of singing all around us, but kind of take it out of that and to kind of laboratize it would be something else again.
If one emphasizes the apophatic thought, is it necessary to insist that Christian art is anachronic? thinking of what a Zen calligrapher would do if trying to express something which would be an empty circle, trying to express the nature of our materiality. I mean, I know you're interested in the visual arts, and you've made reference to music.
Yes, the painter G.F. Watts, who is this great, or if you like, dreadful, Victorian painter of allegorical scenes of love and death and things like, and hope, great inspiration to Barack Obama, and kind of said once, if you wanted to paint a picture of God, the best thing to do would be to draw a lot of squiggles on a piece of paper and then stick your pencil through the paper, and that would be about the best you could come up with. Which is maybe a bit sort of Zen-like for a serious Victorian.
Not quite so aesthetically pleasing, though, as a perfect
No.
So, I mean, Berdia about icons and things. Does he, is this out of my ignorance?
Well, he never writes about them very much, I don't think, but obviously they're part of his church practice. But, I mean, I would stand to be corrected. But, I mean, I think that the liturgical experience of the icon is not as if, as it were, the visual image in itself somehow contains the divine, but it is part of the over, and of course there would be a way of fixating on,
it's like an icon the image,
rather than it's sort of making present the divine in a dynamic and open way, so that the icon is what functions as it does in the context of an overall religious system and shouldn't be.
It's a finger pointing to reality.
Yes. And I suspect that there's a kind of curious thing happened as why icons have become very popular in the West. I mean, the way they're often used is someone, you know, gets a reproduction of Rubgoff's The Trinity, and they take it by its own and kind of put it in a chapel with two candles by it and sit and meditate in front of it and look at it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's how icons are normally used or experienced in the Orthodox Church. I'm not saying that's illegitimate. It is kind of, in a sense, receiving it into a Western tradition of looking at pictures in galleries rather than as parts of a living religious tradition.
The icons are part. How would you react to my original question? There is a momentum here which would make it necessary for Christian art to be
an icon. One of the arguments within the Christian tradition would be that there would be a difference between the icon, for example, and the statue and the three-dimensional image, that it would not be and that the icon as such is and very often is debated, discussed precisely in connection with apophatic mysticism. You should say something on this, Father Ramirez, because it's kind of nearer to your. Yeah. Well, but I mean, it's correct, and I mean, many of the writers would precisely interpret the icon and the use of the icon in intimate connection with the apophatic dimension.
I think that the icon is actually a hypostatic personal presence of the depicted person on the icon. So it's not just pointing out, but it's actually the very presence, real presence of the depicted. And since everything has been created through the Logos, the entire creation is logosic, actually. So anything can be logosic or iconic. In these terms, I think even the Orthodox have a problem in understanding that if we just paint one tree or if we paint some simple object, it could be also iconic and logosic. And it could be salvationally logosic. It means, in meaning that it could lead us to Christ. It could be truthful beauty, not just beauty ex-Christic. So I think this is the main problem with Western perception of the icons. Because anything could be iconic in this world if it has been created through Logos. So we experience Christ in anything, in every moment, because it's not just time, but it's space-time.
And would it be true to say then that in a sense the presence of the icon is very analogous to, or maybe in a sense is even the same as what for Marcel or Berdiaev is the presence of the other human face, that it is something
exactly.
That precisely, and therefore has also, at the same time that it is, you know, you can take a photograph of it, it is obviously a visible object, but it also, in a sense, is no less mysterious than the mystery of any actual person.
Yes, it's actual person. This is the way we understand it, at least. I mean, and this is why we believe that, and we experienced, I think, that icons perform miracles. How would that be possible if they don't? They are not living persons. They perform miracles. They are miracle-working icons, and we have special services written just for a particular icon. Why is that so? This is a very interesting point, I think.
And also, what struck me the first time I experienced Orthodox worship is the way people go in and kiss the icon. Yeah. You know, that the first thing you do, as when you see your friend at a party, is, you know, you kiss them. You don't sort of stand there and look and surprise. It's not pictures in a gallery in that way.
And therefore, with the old believers, they have a watchman next to the icon to make sure that the Orthodox don't kiss the icon.
Yeah,
is that right? Yeah.
That's interesting what you were saying there, but technology presumably couldn't be iconic.
Cyberspace, I think, cannot only be iconic because you can create two exactly same things in cyberspace. You can actually make a perfect copy. So this is the only, this is the biggest achievement of the new civilization. Because it's absolutely anti-Christic, because Christ creates, Godfather creates everything through Christ in a personal way. And man has managed to create something, to create two absolutely identical copies, which is actually the spirit of the Antichrist, I think.
But I think it's very, which kind of brings, you know, I mentioned at the sort of end of the paper, I mean, I think it's easy to think of Marcel and Berdyaev being, you know, as they both sort of died years and years and years ago. But I mean, I do think a number of their emphasis and motifs have really resurfaced, and certainly in later Derrida and some other recent kind of post-structuralist thinkers, really. I mean, I mentioned Marcel's kind of idea of the saturated phenomenon and the way this is kind of being looked about as something people just discovered in the last 10 years, thanks to Jean-Luc Marion, and which, I mean, I have no idea, but he quite probably cites Marcel himself. But this sort of emphasis on the singularity and the uniqueness and the irreplaceability of the person, and the differentiation is the characteristic of personal life, that, you know, each of us is a unique event in the history of the cosmos, and when we die, that unique event will pass away and won't recur. And you can see very much that kind of emphasis in a number of Derrida's late writings, and interesting in his kind of series of interviews on technology and television. I mean, he precisely contrasts, in a sense, as the two of the sort of dialectical poles of our time. On the one hand, there is this kind of technical there is the sort of artifactual virtual world,
the same thing on the one hand,
and the singularity on the other. And it is the tension of these two, kind of extreme singularity and extreme reproducibility, that in a sense mark out the trajectory of the culture we're living.
But if I could add just something to the question of the lady about the icons being iconic, in what way? It's not just in the matter of the forms, in terms of the forms and of the colors, but by being not only anthropocentric product. Because when somebody paints icons, he prays, because he understands art as God-man's creation, theanthropic creation. So in order to make a true piece of art, we need only also the presence of the God in it. This is what makes icon a true icon, the real presence of the God in it.
And certainly, as at least one of my Russian friends has said, you know, why don't you get that postcard of that icon, and then we can take it to a priest and bless it, have it blessed, and then it'll be an icon. But it's not just, as it were, the visual image itself that makes it iconic, but it's the whole process of prayer as well. And
but not faith. Only by being blessed by the priest, because it would be magic or something automatic. But it takes humbling, and it takes prayer, and it takes repentance, and So it requires entire man, and the process of apophatic theology is the process of the purification of the passions, not just the purification of the mind. And also, I don't think, I mean, perhaps I'm wrong, but, and I'm interested in this subject, is there a notion of the heart in the Western mysticism, because it's the very center of the Eastern mysticism, Eastern Orthodox mysticism, the notion of the heart, which is actually the center of our person.
Well, I mean, there certainly is, I mean, I obviously didn't go into that, but for someone like Augustine, I mean, this is absolutely central, you know, he begins his confessions, you know, with this great line, you know, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you, and the iconography of St. Augustine, you know, he's always holding this flaming heart. Mm-hmm. That's how you know who he is. Mm-hmm. And that's a very strong tradition all the way through. Mm-hmm.
I think the heart will have to wait to
another
next,
time.
We have to wind up. Well, I'd like to thank you, George, very, very much indeed. Well, I find it really interesting because you've got there. I've never thought of apophaticism in relation to the human person. I've always thought about it in relation to transcendence or God or something. But I think you've demonstrated to us that this is, you know, the term also links to the human person, and that religiously you can't understand the transcendence without the notion of the human person. So I think that's really interesting.
And I think the kind of shift really from the sort of Augustine Gregory model, where this is very much conceived in a sense under monastic presences of withdrawal from the world. Mm-hmm. And how this in a sense gets rediscovered in the post-Kantian context. Mm-hmm. And there are similarities and differences there. May I just give an advert that the Modern Theology Seminar next Monday afternoon 2:15 might continue this conversation with someone from Liverpool Hope University speaking, Patrice Haynes, on transcendence, the question of transcendence in recent continental philosophy of religion. She's someone who's coming out of the study of French phenomenology, particularly Merleau-Ponty, I think.
Well,
2:15 next Monday at Christchurch.
I come if I can. Well, thank you very much.